biggest question happening in venture capital now is who's right.
Ed Sim, a world-renowned enterprise technology investor and founder of Bold Start, an inception-focused venture firm that he scaled from $1 million to $850 million in assets under management. When you're evaluating founders to put checks behind, what are the main signals that you're filtering through?
I like to think about it in mental models and framework. I call it the five P's. The first thing, it starts with the second thing would be the weekend test.
He was the first investor in unicorn startups like Sneak, Block Demon, and Customer.
I need to give you $10 million. I need to give you $20 million. Let's supersize this shit.
Was listed as the world's number one seed investor by Business Insider in 2024.
If I can't move with speed, guess what? Someone else will. I want to keep up with you, founder. Fucking drive me.
I love that.
You know the PhDs I'm going to fund? Poor, hungry, and determined. It's a different game. You better put your fucking helmet on. You better put your goggles on.
Do you think Bold Start would have been successful without Kathy?
No. It's fucking lonely and hard being a founder. So I'm like, Kath, we're going to have to drain our savings. I'm not going to get a salary for I don't know how long. And she's like, Ed, I would rather you do something you love and wake up loving every day because I believe in you. And she did not waver from that. I'm talking about mortgage, two kids in private school. She fucking did not waver from that. And the question is it going to be $5 trillion? Is it going to be $10 trillion? I don't know. And this is the most exciting time that I've seen in 28 years ever because no one knows the answer. And that's where the most fun happens.
I really want to do a masterclass in early stage investing. Early stage investing kind of gets grouped in as just single thing, but it's I think there's layers to it, right?
Yep.
How do you define inception investing and that where you focus?
Inception investing is meeting people. And for us, it's technical enterprise founders. For someone else, it might be different, but technical enterprise founders who we want to partner with, help them collaborate early, battle test their ideas early. We can go to our Fortune 500 network of CXOs and CIOs. We can go to our portfolio companies who are at scale now and help them iterate these things faster. And then once they get that story together, we can help them iterate their story. Like, what are you doing? What aisle, what shelf? Are you a new category? Are you reinventing an existing one? And then we can kind of lead or co-lead that round out of the gates. That's what inception investing in. And in my province, I want to be specific, is that there's three kinds of inception rounds, and it folds into the prior categories from the past. The discovery round is a $0 to $2 million round. That's usually a first-time founder. Maybe it's a new idea, a new category like Wasm or something like that, right? They're like, I just want $1.5 million to explore. Because if it doesn't work, maybe I'll just kind of sell the business and then go back and do something else. I don't feel like really attached to it. But if it takes off, let's graduate to another round. The next round would be a classic round. It's a $3 to $5 million round. That's usually like probably people that you hire. Director of engineering, who's an up-and-coming star, who's going to get hired to be a VP of engineering. They come from a pedigreed company. And they're like, you know, I just want to raise $3 to $4 million because I got this idea that's built on everything that I've done in my entire life. And I see this unique insight, technical insight, where I can build a business. And what happens then is that's a 3 to 5. That's what seed used to be. Except once again, this is an idea. This is not a 2.7-year-old company. And the problem is that if that person's so well-spoken and so smart, I can hire the talent, and they meet a multi-stage firm. You know what the multi-stage firm's going to do?
What?
Shit, I need to give you $10 million. I need to give you $20 million. Let's supersize this shit. McDonald's fries, this big, baby. I want a big shake too. And so then they start throwing out and dangling a $10 to $20 million check. And so that's the last round is a jumbo round. Those are all inception rounds. And usually though, in our parlance, the best kind of jumbo founder is usually a second or third time founder. Perhaps it's kind of going after an established market or something like that. Probably exited, made some good money for people. Those are the ones you're probably going to feel more comfortable writing a $10 to $12 million check.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, the lane or game you need to play is as an inception investor, or if you're a pre-seed seed or whatever, mm-hmm. is am I only going to stay in the swim lane on the left, less than $2 million? Well, that's going to dictate fund size. Am I going to stay in the swim lane of only 3 to 5, right? Once again, they'll dictate my fund size in 100, 150, or mm-hmm. do I want to play in the jumbo category?
Before we dive into the actual nuts and bolts of things, I'm just curious, like real time, what are the biggest shifts that you've seen in the last couple of years here, or maybe even very recently in the venture space and investing in general, that you think every investor listening right now should be paying attention to?
I think shift number one is that post-ZIRP, the world has gotten corrected. I think people have to rethink everything they thought was the right way to do things. And back in the ZIRP days, where every round was preemptive, people just kept hiring and hiring like crazy, burning like crazy, thinking that growth at all costs was the way it was supposed to be. And people got rewarded for that. I'm really, really excited now to see shifting back to fundamentals. It's all about building a real business. Like eventually the venture capital is going to dry up and you're going to actually have to generate some profits, right? So so it just makes common sense, doesn't it? There's no more like fairy tale, wave some pixie dust. However, that's happening on the one side. On the other side, there's almost this disconnect. There's this thing called AI. And by the way, I've been through this AI thing before, back in 2017, 2018, 2019. That was kind of the first wave, but it was more equivalent of like Alexa. It was all, you know, ontologies and classifications. And now you just throw stuff in to spit it out. But you see the valuations of these companies, they're fucking off the charts.
Like the top 20 companies recently funded had $20 billion of market value and less than $100 million collectively in revenue.
Who's right? Right? Who's right? So that is the biggest question happening in venture capital now, is who's right? There are 99 things or 999 things that can go wrong when I meet someone. But if the one thing that happens that goes right, how right is that? How big can that fucking be? Mm. And no one knows the answer right now. No one knows, but people are making their bets. People are spraying their money around. And we will find out every year that goes by. We'll turn the cards over on the poker table to figure out who's right and who's wrong. For every 1,000 startups that are out there, there'll probably be 5 to 10 that are actually game changing. So there's probably 990 that won't be right. How right will the 10 be? I think they'll be fucking absolutely enormous. Mm-hmm. Because what we're really talking about here in this wave of AI is not just the software total addressable market that's there. I'm talking about labor. I'm talking about jobs to be done. And you're talking about $5 to $10 trillion of kind of labor impact. The question is it going to be $5 trillion? Is it going to be $10 trillion? I don't know. But that is what is at stake right now. And no one knows what the answer is, but everyone's fucking making their bets. And this is the most exciting time that I've seen in 28 years ever, because no one knows the answer. And that's where the most fun happens.
I love that, man. Within AI, because AI is this big subset now, you have like foundation models, like the Anthropics, the Open AIs, you have, you know, application use cases, vertical point solutions. You have all these different AI applications. Are there areas where you feel like are like overhyped and like, hey, I don't want to play in that zone because there's going to be like one or two major winners and like it's so impossible to figure out who's are and I got to go focus on something more pragmatic? Or how do you think through the AI landscape and where to invest?
I think there's so many different lenses to approach kind of AI investing. And first of all, from my perspective, I never really said I'm an AI investor, because in my opinion, which I've always said, and actually Satya said a few years ago, that AI is a technology. And it's going to be infused in every piece of enterprise software where it makes sense and where people will pay for it. Mm. So, you know, I think in my opinion, like if I look at my existing portfolio, none of them were AI companies 3 years ago. But if you look at it now, 85% of our portfolio, I'm talking about 60, 70 enterprise hardcore startups, have an AI related feature kind of in production today. And by next year, it'll be 95%. So am I an AI investor or not? No, I think about fucking fundamental problems that need to be solved. Secondly, when you ask the question about what layer, whether it's the model layer, the infrastructure layer, or the app layer, first of all, I think as an investor, you know, you need to know what game are you playing? What's your swim lane? Mm. For me, our swim lane is being first. And being first is inception investing. That's literally collaborating with founders when they are thinking about starting their next company, helping them iterate and battle test their ideas, maybe helping them pre-sell their first hires. And that could be a process of 1 month. It could be a process of a year. But once they are ready, and they have that 5 or 6 ready to go, those hires ready to go, I want to be there and lead or co-lead that round at inception. Because what happens then is that they're not going to go out and incorporate a company and then try to raise money and take 6 to 12 months and dick around trying to raise the rest of the capital and then hire people. That's, you just lost 18 months.
Yeah.
Like you want to come in out of the gates fucking firing, right? And so that's the game I play. And within that game, there's only so much capital I can deploy at so many points in time. I mean, our last fund was slightly under $200 million. Because we thought that was the right number to lead and co-lead these rounds. And the game that I'm talking about is the model game. That giant sucking size you see in the industry. Mm-hmm. God bless the people who can play that game. That's a game for $5 billion, $10 billion funds.
Yeah.
And so I know that's not a game I want to play. Secondly, there are going to be some massive winners, but you know, in my opinion, all roads eventually lead to the cloud providers. They're the only ones that eventually have the money and the stamina.
And you're seeing these big companies like Microsoft. They're acquiring the startups like Inflection and all these top guys. They're acquiring them right up immediately.
And that's not the game that I'm built to play. Right. And others are going to play it, and some are going to be absolutely fabulously wealthy from doing it, and others won't be. But the game I want to play is that every time there's a new release, if you look at the gap in terms of accuracy from the open source models to the proprietary models, it's like this right now. And the gap's almost negligible right now.
Yeah.
So the gap I want to play, the game I want to play is, okay, every time there's a new release, how do we take advantage of it? Will the company that I invest in, will they leverage that technology? Will they deliver a better product because of the models themselves that are getting better?
Yeah.
Or not? And so if you ask that question, then the next would be, what layer of the stack? traditionally, Boldstart has been an infra investor. We've probably deployed about three-quarters of our dollars into infrastructure investing. I'm talking about dev tools, resiliency, keeping the lights on, cybersecurity, data infrastructure, you know, all that kind of stuff. And 25% of the app layer, companies like Superhuman, where we're the first check up front.
Yeah, amazing.
Or Customer, where we had a massive exit, which was supposedly a billion, but who knows what that was. but now it's about 50-50.
Wow.
Because I think that AI, the AI infrastructure level is so crowded. There's so many point features. I mean, who needs an AI prompt engine? Do you think that a whole company should be a better prompting engine for AI? Do you think there should be, you know, a monitoring for how my AI model's performing? Well, shouldn't Datadog and some of the other ones do it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's a tough stack. In fact, and then OpenAI is, you know, and all these other model providers are actually expanding beyond just an API for their model.
Yeah.
They're expanding into more applications. I mean, you know, OpenAI search right now, apparently they're gonna come out with code. Wow. I mean, this is an absolute game. So I want to go up the stack, because when I started Boldstart in 2010, seed investing wasn't even a thing, right? It was like, the only people that were out there were like First Round and maybe Jeff Clavier from SoftTech, which called Uncork, Mike Maples. And these were generalists. They were just, you know, seed was before A. Before that, it was A was the First Round. So people thought we were nuts, because they're like, you're Boldstart, you're actually in New York, you're doing seed and you're doing it in enterprise only. Like, wow, that really narrows your gap. And the reason that we started it back in the day was because I started watching the founders, right? You know, I think as an investor, people forget that you also have to think like a founder. Mm. And all the founders that I had worked with previously, because I've been doing this for 28 years, like, hey, Ed, there's this thing called open source. There's this thing called Amazon EC2, which was launched like in 2007, 2008. I just need $1 million to get started. I don't need a lot of money to get started. And I want actually professional advice. So, and no VCs will write a check to me for less than 3 to 5. So that's where kind of seed got started for enterprise.
Mm.
Fast forward, as seed got cool, people were like, let me see if I can go earlier, because the more money that people raise from institutions, the more they wanted to see to be less risky in a way, right? Because they're like, hey, I want a little more traction. I think if I get more traction, then it's gonna be more of a sure thing for me to deliver returns to investors. So pre-seed was created. Fast forward, I was looking at the data from PitchBook last year in October, November, when I was really kind of conceiving of this. Do you know what the median age of a company is that raises the pre-seed round according to PitchBook?
A year old?
Yeah, 1.2 years old. Wasn't that the round that was supposed to be two people and an idea and their dog? Like, I mean, that wasn't that the idea of pre-seed was like nothing built? So I think as pre-seed became a category, the same thing happened that happened to seed. Did you know that the median age of a seed company now that raises the round is 2.7 years old?
Oh, wow.
So the founder, first-time founder, the third-time founder, that founder that's going to come out of the gate and say, hey, I've been working on this idea, you know, I'm not incorporated yet, or I'm about to get incorporated, and I want to raise a round, whether it's $500K, a million, $10, $20 million, who do I go to? I don't fucking know, right?
That's interesting, because you're a founder at this stage, you're betting on the founder, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's no metrics you're looking at,
mm-hmm.
right? You might be able to look at their background, their mm-hmm. history, and get some signals of greatness or not, but since you're so founder-focused, is it a benefit, or does it kind of block you in a sense to hyper-focus on enterprise tech, for instance, if you meet this exceptional founder that's technical, that can solve a problem? Like, how important is it for you to actually truly understand the space they're building in versus just bet on the person?
That is the essence of the question. I mean, for us, I think it's both. I call it founder market fit, and you might say it's a cop-out. But let me just really make it simple for you in enterprise software. I've been doing this for 28 years. I also coded a little bit at JP Morgan back in the day. But I think there's only a few things that you can do in the enterprise, and it just gets reinvented over and over and over again. First thing is you develop core software. So that's selling into IT. You help that software get maintained. You help that software get secure. And you store the data. So that's kind of that.
Those are the four pillars, really, that
define
the whole enterprise investing stack.
On IT. Okay. Stack two would be employee productivity. How do I help my employees be more productive? So that could be anything from Microsoft Excel to any other collaboration tool or anything else, right? So that's the app layer. So what do my employees touch? And then wedge number three, these are just the third thing, is customers, customer relationship. That's it. Like, how do I interact with my customers? How do I do support better? How do I sell to my customers better? Whether it's, those are the three things. They just get fucking reinvented over and over and over again. I mean, I'll give you a good example, like customer with a K. They were reinventing customer support. And the unique idea that Brad and Jeremy had when we funded them was that, you know, and this was after they sold a company to Salesforce, another customer support company, was that, hey, you know what? People are getting tired. They don't want to be treated like a ticket. Because if you and I reached out to support, if we reached out through the phone or WhatsApp or email, we would be in three different systems. Why not just have one view of the customer and you are it? And so when you reach out by phone and email and text, you must be fucking pissed. Like, let's prioritize that. Let's look at all their data. That's a simple idea, but that was the idea. Oh, by the way, I'd done another customer support company called LivePerson, which was one of the first SaaS hosted companies back in 98. And we sold that, actually took it public. It was one of the last IPOs back in 2000. So I've done that so many times. So the reason I'm saying this is because by knowing how these things are built and who the buyers are and everything else, you're informed about how quickly is this really unique enough? How big, you know? So when you're making that decision, when I'm looking at the founder, are they full of shit? Like, can I actually dive in a layer? Like, you know, and so the ability to have founder market fit and to understand your market really well allows us to move with speed, because speed is the other thing that, you know, we can talk about later. If I can't move with speed and this is a great founder, guess what? Someone else will. And so there's a whole bunch of things that go into it, but I think it's both that really matters. And for us, this is the lane that we picked. This is the game that we're playing. And the third thing I was about to say is that I never finished it. The third part about the inception rounds and the jumbo, we decided to play in the jumbo game too. And so we've literally written a check as big as $12 million out of the gate for a third time founder. And we've written checks as small as $500K. And you're like, dude, like, honestly.
Have you noticed, if you look at patterns across your fund from like the couple million dollar up to the $12 million inception round, which is a lot of money to give someone with just an idea. Yep. Have you seen the data across those where you actually saw the biggest returns? Did those actually pay off, or were the earlier ones better?
I'll tell you, like, the craziest thing about venture is that I don't think I'm that good right now, because like the feedback cycles are so long until you return shit tons of cash to your investors. And that can take 10 to 12 years, right?
10 to 12 years, you don't know if you're good.
Exactly. And the feeling that I always have is that we're never good, right? You know, like, and like, if you wake up the feeling that you think you're good, then you're never going to strive to be world-class. And if you think you're world-class, then you probably should not think that way, because you'll never be maintaining that,
right,
that category. But to your question, I'll give you a good example. Protect AI. I can actually give this example, I think, because they've released all their numbers. But they did a jumbo inception round at, you know, a $10 million round back in, well, we started iterating with the founders. It's got Ian Swanson and Dee and Badar back in October of 21. And the reason I bring this story up is because as an inception investor, what you want to do is partner with founders who see around corners. I'm not the guy coming up with the idea, the founder is. So I just have to vet them. And at that time, those guys, two of the guys, were coming out of AWS. They're leading go-to-market for their AI group, AI and ML group. And like, holy shit, I think there's a big problem coming down the pike. I think that large enterprises right now have no idea of the security of their AI models that they're deploying. And mind you, this is pre the ChatGPT moment. This was just them sitting there with customers. And they're like, what if I could provide a dashboard and say, hey, you have 50 AI models in production right now, or machine learning back in the day, it was more ML than AI. And let me tell you how secure they are. Like, you know, the data hasn't been tampered with. The software itself is pretty secure, right? Because you've updated all the vulnerabilities and blah, and the models themselves haven't been attacked. And we're like, okay, love the founder. We've known him for 10 years. We're like, do we believe there's a market here? Yeah, one of these days, there's going to be a seminal moment one day in which there'll be some massive hack that requires people to have this. But if it doesn't happen, we do think that he can sell his way to $10 million in 3 years. So he raised a $10 million round, you know, at a, like a 30 million post-ish, right? Fast forward, holy shit, we didn't know, but ChatGPT came around like in October, November of 22. Wow, we're in the right place at the right time. We already had a product ready to go. Fast forward, you know, they raised a new round, like a $37 million A round, you know, like after a year and a half we had partnered with them. And just this summer, they raised another 60 at 460 post. So is that a success? I won't say it's a success because we haven't returned the capital yet, but
yeah,
I can tell you it's trending in the right direction. And we were early. We caught the wave before it happened. We found people that saw around corners.
Yes.
And so that's kind of where I find the history of it. And yeah, he just happened to need 10 million because he was also a third time founder. So either you play the game or not.
Because you're focusing so niche down enterprise and you know the patterns in the space, you just have a higher probability of making the right guesses versus if you met a deep tech founder who's super impressive, but you have no idea what the landscape is. It could be great, but you don't have enough data to see the pattern.
Yeah. And would I be missing some things? Yeah. But at the same time, it constrains my universe to only focus on the people that are building in these areas so that when we do see them, we can move very, very fast.
What do you look for? Cause like you have a niche down in technical founders. yep. right? Technical founders, beyond them being technical and having some sort of insight where they can see around a corner, when you're evaluating founders to put checks behind, we'll say even first-time founders versus yep. people that have clear signals of greatness.
Yeah.
What are the main signals that you're filtering through?
I like to think about it in mental models and frameworks, and I've been doing this a long time. So I've kind of distilled my own kind of brain. I call it the five P's. And for me, the first thing, it starts with the people. Why are you the person that's going to reinvent the space or create a new category? What is, give me the reason to believe, to take that leap of faith with you, that you're going to be doing this. And maybe there's a history of you launching new products and new categories that are very successful. Perhaps you're a rock star and you just have an ability to articulate the future. Of course, we're going to do the reference checks on you. So the people, that's part one. And along with the people is, I want to know, who are the people that are going to follow you? The best people are Pied Pipers, right? They already have five or six people that are going to follow them every single time they go. And I said, give me a list right now. Who are the five or six people, right? Because if you have no one coming from the prior past, that's a problem. So people. Second thing is, because this is the enterprise, technical founders in the enterprise. Second is, what's the pain? Like, is this a pain that is just so massive, it's a hair on fire problem today, or for the people or constituency you're going after, or is it just kind of nice to have? I mean, that's super important. So that's a basic. The third would be product. What is the unique technical insight? What is the magic that you're bringing to the table, born out of the experience that you have? Because a lot of the best enterprise founders, like the Protect AI example, he was living in the space. And he's like, holy shit, I see a gap. We're not doing an AWS, and I think I can build a company. So usually it's born out of that. And that was the insight that he had, because he talked to so many customers. He already had the insight, and we helped validate that. So product, on top of the product, you have to have an ability to zoom in and have user empathy. You need to understand, like, why, Chris, in your day-to-day life, is the product or solution I'm going to offer you going to make your life 10 times better or 100 times better? How's it going to make you a hero? So having that user empathy is very important. But at the same time, you have to have the ability to zoom out, because you may not be the budget owner. How do I zoom out and tell a story to the budget owner, whether it's the CIO or the security person or whatever? So that's product. So that's part three. Part four is passion. Man, we talked about this earlier, right? This is like a, it's like a, I got a great example. So my son, he loved, you know, he played all these different sports with helmets, like hockey and football and what. And so his coach when he was 10 was kind of giving the Any Given Sunday kind of speech. And I was listening, and he goes, football is not a full contact sport. It's a collision sport. And I was like, yeah, startups, inception investing, starting companies is not a full contact sport. It's a collision sport. You're going to go 60 miles an hour, drive right into a brick wall, fucking be shattered into pieces. You got to glue yourself back together, get up off the floor. So passion, because this journey is going to be really, really hard. And so I want founders who aren't sitting there on a whiteboard coming out of business school saying, oh, there's white space here. Let me throw some AI, slap some AI and go out and do it. And by the way, some people have done that and done just fine. In the enterprise, I feel like it's better when you have a Brad and Jeremy who are like, oh, this is my third customer support startup. And I already sold the last one to Salesforce. And by the way, this is the bigger insight. You know, the funniest thing is after we sold that company, we're working with them again. We bought the company out of Meta. So that's another story to be done.
Oh my God.
So that's number four. And the fifth one is potential. And this we talked about earlier is that, look, venture capital is not for everyone. If you decided to go raise venture capital, then you have to realize that I have a job. My job is to return as much money as possible back to my investors. Hopefully you're aligned with that journey and we go do that together. And hopefully it's a founder-friendly environment and all these other things. But the fifth P is potential. If right, how fucking big can this be? Because literally there's zero reason why you should go to venture capitalists if you're not going to actually have an idea that can be really big. And by the way, it's okay if you start small. I really do think that's where people miss a lot of opportunity, is that they expect the big TAM. Well, guess what? If there's a big existing TAM, you're gonna have a shit ton of companies already in that space. So you better really have a unique insight and unique way of doing things. If it's a small TAM, perhaps a new market. I love new markets. I love creating new markets. But the problem is I just don't know, like in the Protect AI space, I literally did not know if that thing would, I could not have predicted, you know, ChatGPT coming around. But like, we're literally selling into the biggest banks in the world right now within 3 years. But I did not predict it. I just figured like, hey, like we'll get there.
Yeah.
And so I think that the potential, if right, how big, is the thing that people really need to focus on versus if wrong, because everything can go wrong. There's only one small thing can go right, but if it's right. So those are the five P's.
Yeah.
If you look at those lenses and check those boxes off, I think it's a pretty good framework for anyone looking at people and assessing them. But, you know, and figuring out how to make it.
That's a really, really good framework. Let's do a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. You're talking to three founders.
Yeah.
and you have to decide who you want to invest in, but you can't ask them any questions about their business, strictly just based off who they are as a person. What would you want to ask them? What would you want to know about these people to know who's the most investable and has the highest probability of giving you a return?
You know, for me, I go back to the passion point. When I meet people and they talk about what problem they're solving and why, and probably when you meet people too, when you're looking to recruit them for something, you just know. You feel them jump off the page or jump off the screen, and then you meet them in person, you just feel the energy. There's an infectious energy about someone's idea. So it's kind of an intangible thing versus kind of knowing. So part of that's what's one. And just doing it for a long time, I feel like I've got a pretty good feeling on that. I'd say the second thing is, and by the way, you're hearing things that are not the question, but actually how you operate, I think, is it? Because you're passionate as fuck about what you do. I am too. But second thing would be the weekend test. I kind of like ask founders, like after I meet them, I've been really thinking about investing in them. I'll send them stuff on a Friday night at 8 p.m., Saturday morning at 6 a.m. Because I'm up. I have nothing better to do. This is what I fucking do. I love doing this. I don't know what they're doing. If this is the time where they're going to take my money and this is when they're starting a company, which is going to be life-changing for them, I want to see how quickly they respond.
I love that. I love that. Because you can always say, hey, what's the hardest you've worked on something?
Fuck that.
Tell me this, but like you want to see how they actually act.
And then say, hey, guess what? Hey, I'm available 11, 12, 1, 4, 5. I'll ruin my own Saturday just to see. You know, it's not like I make 50 investments a year. We'll make 10 investments a year for a firm.
Yeah.
8 to 10.
Yeah.
So I can ruin 8 to 10 Saturdays or 15 Saturdays. And it's not ruining it. It's like, great, I'll hop on. I'll give you any fucking time you want Saturday right now. How quickly can you answer? We jump in a Zoom right now, wherever you are. One guy was like, Ed, I'm at my daughter's birthday party. Give me 5 minutes. I'm like, I knew that guy because I was trying to test him. And you know what this reminds me of? I remember at Green Plum, which was one of the first open source data warehousing companies. This was back in the day. Mm-hmm. And we ended up selling it to EMC and then it went public as Pivotal and got sold for, you know, $5 billion. But I remember I was interviewing the CEO. And I was like, hey, Bill. This guy, Bill Cook, he was most recently CEO of Yugabyte, which raised a shit ton of money in the data space.
Yeah.
I go, Bill, and he was running at the time the storage division at Sun Microsystems. It was a $1 billion division. I go, Bill, like, you got great background, you understand the space, you seem hungry, but like, how do I know you don't have two EAs? And like, how do I know that you're not actually, how do I know you're a startup guy? And this was about 6 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, New York time. He's on the West Coast, 3 o'clock. And he goes, Ed, what are you doing tomorrow morning for breakfast? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I'm going to meet you tomorrow for breakfast. You name the place and I'm meeting you.
And he was on the other coast?
Yeah. He got in a fucking red eye. I met him for breakfast. We spent 2 hours together. He became CEO. He built a fucking killer business and he's a friend for life. But that was it. It was not what he told me. Is what he fucking did. He got in a fucking red eye that day, busy guy, and just, he made me change my schedule. So I wanna keep up with them. I wanna keep up with you, founder. Fucking drive me. I wanna feed off your energy. I can't give you the energy. I'm here along for the ride. So that, it's not even the questions, it's what you do. But ultimately, you see what it is. It's like, I am absolutely insanely passionate about what I do. I'm obsessed with what I'm about to do. I fucking wanna win. And that's what you're showing me.
That, I love that. That is a big truth bomb right there, is really observing how intense and how committed people are, and just everyone can speak the language, but observing that. I'm curious for you, because we talked offline, Parker Conrad, you know, CEO of Rippling, $1 billion company with the most successful founders in the history of the world. You mentioned he was your intern at one point.
Yeah.
Did you see any of those signals of greatness from the point where he was your intern? Did you notice anything there?
Oh man, he was always challenging us every step of the way. He was like the smartest guy in the room already as a sophomore in college. And Parker definitely challenged us. He was a difficult guy, but this is why he's the CEO of Rippling. Cause he just pushed the buttons and just had a vision. And so the last time, I haven't talked to him in a long time, but the last time I was telling you I saw him, cause you're mentioning Rippling, was at the Coatue kind of event a few years ago, the East meets West. And I went up to Parker, I'm like, yo, it's your boss here. He started laughing. And we took a nice picture together. We hugged it out. Yeah. And anyway, the guy's a fucking star. He's awesome.
But you look for that. You look for people that are kind of rebellious.
Yeah.
That have a really line in the sand, like, this is how things should be. And I'm willing to challenge you no matter what seniority level they're at. You just look for those rebels.
Yeah, I would say, and they know kind of how to balance that whole rebellious aspect, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't say they have to be a rebel,
yeah.
But like, it's not like every reference check you do is saying that they're a good soldier. Usually the reference checks you do, and you do a lot too, would be like, I look for the signals where they piss off their managers because they do things too fast because they get frustrated, right? Maybe they just end around and say, I don't want to go do the proper approvals. I just want to get shit done.
Yeah.
And that's right. I mean, those are the people that work and thrive in a startup environment.
Absolutely.
And so that's probably what I look for, less than rebels, right? You know, it's almost like the same thing as, this fucking annoys me too. Like, you know, here's the profile of a rebel. Well, I don't know what a rebel is, but I'm just trying to tell you kind of just people that want to get shit done. And then two is, it always drives me nuts too, is like, you need to be contrarian to be their best investor. I'm just thinking that my job is not to be contrarian. My job is there to be there before anyone else is there and sees the future.
Yes.
My job is to be there and work with founders who see the future, that I don't know if that future is going to take 1 year or 5 years to take hold. But once it takes hold, I would hope it's not fucking contrarian anymore. Right. So
right.
So it's like, I want to invest in the thing that is kind of like, so my partner, Elliot Durbin, says, he tilts his head and says, why are you doing that? But then 2 years later, he's like, how do I get a piece of this?
Right. Exactly. So
it's not contrarian, in my opinion. You're just early.
You're just early. And by rebel, it's kind of just rebelling against the status quo of how most people operate, right?
Yeah,
it's
being just frustrated by...
You see the future and you're just impatient to get there.
Yeah.
You're like, let's drive. What are we waiting for?
Yep.
Like, how do you not see this?
Yep.
Right? And those people, if they can balance that with logic and actually have competence in that space, are dangerous.
Absolutely dangerous. And that's where the most fun happens, right? Because look, at the end of the day, let me just tell you, this is fun. I love this.
I can tell you have a lot of fun doing what you do, which I think honestly is like a key element to being world-class, is like, if it's work for you and fun for someone else, they're going to crush you.
Yeah. Yeah. This is just fun. Like, I love waking up every day and kind of with the challenge. Every day is different, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, and every startup's different and every market's different, but it's just, it's fun.
What was the biggest return you've created so far?
Okay. So the biggest return dollar-wise would be just kind of the exit of customer to Meta, which, you know, I think Bloomberg had reported was over $1 billion, but we were kind of there from the very beginning at inception with the founders. And more importantly, it's kind of funny, these relationships that you build with, you know, Brad and Jeremy over time, it's multi-pronged, right? In the sense that they ended up investing in our fund. So the same fund that returned, that they returned more than the whole fund, they're also investors.
They're LPs in it too?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
They're also LPs in all of our other funds since then. And so, and they send us deal flow, and we send deals back and forth. And so, you know, I had this also unusual experience where we had the opportunity to buy them back from Meta with our friends at Redpoint and Battery. So we get to do a second act with them, which is really, really unusual that they're still driven to keep doing this after a massive exit. So that would be the ultimately realized on paper.
Because that's realized on paper. One I know that I don't think has been realized yet that's super impressive is Snake.
Yes,
yeah,
Guy Pajarni.
Snake with Guy Pajarni.
Yeah.
Tell me that story. How did Snake come to be? Because at one point, I know with the height, they're at 8.6 billion. I think it's corrected a little bit since then.
Yeah, like seven. Yeah, but the company's performing. So let me tell you an interesting story. Just yesterday, we released a note, and I kind of tweeted it out to support them, but they said that their AI product called Sneak Code crossed the $100 million ARR mark, and it represents about a third of their revenue. And on top of that, they also put out in the press release that it actually grew 40% year over year, and the last quarter accounted for 70% of new enterprise deals. So the reason they sent that out was like, hey, you think of Sneak as kind of this older company that's been around for 9 years, but no, our AI products is soaring through the roof right now. All of the code you're being generated that is by the AI assistants needs security and security AI bots to monitor it.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. Sorry. So Sneak is a funny story. So Guy, we had actually funded Guy out of Fund One. We had $1 million fund, man. This was like lots of
money. You started with $1 million. That was the whole fund.
2010.
And now you're what, at 850?
Yeah, somewhere around there. And and the challenge for us is not to get too big, right? And we can talk.
So you don't want to play the AUM game. You want to play the return game.
Nope. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. And so Guy, we funded his company. He was reinventing how and speeding up the delivery of content to of web pages to devices and to internet browsers. We sold that to Akamai. Hey, look, it was a nice solid return, but it wasn't like, you know, for $1 million fund, it was great, right? And then I stayed in touch with Guy. So he went to Akamai. He's like, let me stick here for a couple of years and learn a lot, because it was a public company and it was a hot company. And every quarter I'm like, all right, Guy, let's catch up. Like, I'm looking at these companies in security, I'm looking at these companies in infrastructure, and I would always get his feedback. I'm like, when do you start your next company? And this would go on for about 2.5 years. And Guy and I got to be pretty good friends. And one day he's like, all right, Ed, finally I'm ready. He goes, I've got three ideas. And first idea was, yeah, maybe a consumer-y kind of thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's not the best idea. I'm not going to give you any money. Second idea was kind of a B2B thing. I was like, oh, I'll give you a couple hundred K. And the third K was, I got this idea to reinvent security for developers and create something called developer-friendly security. And I'm like, all right, tell me more. I was like, all right, I'll give you $1 million right now at a certain price if it's just you. He goes, and then I said, if you get a co-founder, because I thought co-founder is very important, I'll give you another price. He goes, okay, give me a month. He came back with two co-founders. I'm like, no, that doesn't mean I'm increasing the price of the bar. Exactly. I'm only giving you that. So that was being a sneak.
Yeah.
I was being a sneak. So that was like back in 2015. And he invented this category called developer-friendly security. And you're basically like, what the fuck is developer-friendly security? And this is, I think, very important lesson that I've learned. And yeah. I think it's important for people to learn at inception. I like to say it's not the TAM or total addressable market that you start with.
Yeah.
But it's a TAM you exit with. And let me actually be even more specific about that. I like to say that, what is a product that you're selling today? How is it going to make, you know, Chris or Ed a hero for our little niche thing that we do? Okay. But then what is the bigger vision that you're going to market? So sell the product, market the vision, right? So marketing the vision would be, so for example, he said, I'm going to do developer-friendly security. Well, how many developers are there? I don't know, 20 million developers. Now there are 100 million, 200 million developers, whatever that is. But that's going to be my market. Everyone developer should be able to use that. Then he said, let me go really, really fucking narrow because I do need to zoom in and solve a particular pain. And the particular pain that he was solving for was open source. Think about all the open source packages that large enterprises use and consume. And a lot of them just aren't updated. You don't update the packages and the vulnerabilities are there and you have Heartbleed and all these other things. Yeah. It's a big problem. Mm-hmm. The people have a lot of people maintaining that. And he's like, what if I could create a way? And there was other software out there like Veracode and others that actually found those problems. But you know what the problem was? If you're a developer, you would rather not know that the problem existed because guess what? You've got to go research it and fix it. And that could take hours upon hours figuring out how to research and fix it. He's like, developer-friendly means to me, not only finding the problem, but allowing you to hit one button, creating a fork, and fixing it right there. So now you just shift all of the security issues left so that people can build code faster, so they can solve security faster. And not only did he start with open source, he started out with Node. With JavaScript, Node.js. So really, really narrow. And what we didn't know when we invested, what Guy didn't know, what I didn't know, what we didn't know was how easy would it be for him to move to another language, to move to Ruby, to move to Java, to move to other, we didn't know. But he was already thinking about the bigger vision. He's like, all right, I'm going to spend an extra couple of months when I build out the architecture and framework in which I think will be easier.
It's extensible and you can easily.
Exactly, yeah. Versus just doing the MVP thing, right?
Right?
So this is kind of, there's a whole bunch of lessons, but hey, if it was MVP, ship it fast, he probably would have rebuilt the whole thing. We wouldn't have been sneak, but he actually took the extra time. So patience is needed. If I wanted to add a 6P, sometimes I think it's patience, but he did it. And by the way, no one would fund him for a while because the market's not big enough.
Yeah, didn't you have to give him multiple?
We gave him three rounds.
You gave him three rounds. So that's a good thing to zoom in on.
Yeah.
Like, what made you triple down before you'd even gotten to the A? And I'm imagine before you even hit a few million in revenue.
Oh yeah.
Like and three rounds, you keep deploying capital. How do you know when to deploy and when to just say enough's enough?
That's a great question. So I think this also ties into what are the early signs that you see that will allow you to believe that this will be a successful company that are within the founder's control versus the market control. Because, you know, let's say, for example, that Protect AI could have done everything right, but if the market didn't come around, we'd still be out there kind of cranking along, which is fine. Like, you know, eventually it'll come around, right?
Right.
But what we saw in the second round was, man, holy shit. Guy brought together, you know, seven or eight amazing engineers, and the dude was just shipping product like crazy. So we could already see the open source download traction happening. We could see people using it repeatedly, but there's no revenue. So the third check was basically like, man, there's an inflection point. We have all these downloads, but we're running out of money. And in order to get the next round done, because people didn't believe in the opportunity, mm-hmm. We need revenue. And so he was about to sign his first customer for like, you know, 30K. And he didn't have a signed contract, so no one would fund him. We're like, oh, this is going to happen, right? And we also saw the pipeline behind it of five others. And that was when we gave the third check. And also people are actually trying to acquire him too. They were like, okay. So, and we were helping with some of that. And so that was the third check. And so he basically skipped it from us working with him until kind of the A round was, you know, done with Excel London at the time. He built the company out of London and Israel.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we were based out of New York. So this once again is, I think you're talking about like my, the first company that he started was in Canada. And then this was in London. And people were like, how do you do inception investing out of New York when in all these places? Well, you get in a plane, you travel, you spend a lot of time with the founder. They also come back to New York as well. Cause guess what? The one thing about New York is really interesting at the time was that it had the largest concentration of Fortune 500 kind of companies there. So everyone's kind of coming there and selling into the IT department. You find ways to do, we'll call it long distance dating. That's what I view it as. Cause it gets very intense for 2 or 3 days. Like, for example, we just funded a new company out of London and Vancouver. And then the last 4 days, the founders flew into Miami. Cause guess what? Vancouver, London. Why not come to Miami? So we had some intense sessions together, long distance dating. We'll do it again in a few months, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, so that was kind of the story behind the three rounds before we got to. But fast forward, as I said, it's a sizable ARR business growing very quickly in a very important space and category. So we haven't monetized it yet. But you know, the coolest part for me on that journey is to be on the board from inception and still on the board now.
On that journey.
And just watch, you know, and Guy now has started a new company. And guess what? We were fortunate enough to fund that one too at inception.
Yeah.
And so he hasn't fully announced it yet, but he did say like us and GV were the leads in that.
Very cool.
So more to come. But anyway, these are long journeys. You build relationships with people. It goes back to the people relationship. And I hope founders actually build relationships with their investors too. It's not about the highest valuation. It's not about the highest price. It's like, you want to pick up the phone at 8 o'clock on a Saturday if there's an issue and like the person that you're talking to, right?
Yeah,
so
that's a good point.
I would hope that founders not just choose the brand name, but choose the person.
Choose the person.
And think about it as not just this company, because you know, a 28-year-old, 35-year-old founder is probably going to have a couple swings at the plate. So I would hope they also think about their journey together. Like, is this person going to be with me over time? You know, am I going to build a relationship with them? So I think that's important too.
I'm curious, as an investor, how important is it to look at that early round, whether it's like a 20 million post, 30 million, 40 million, if it's a great founder and you believe in the company, do you have hard rules about what you'll invest at that stage in terms of post valuation? Or like, is it just kind of, because it has an implication on your multiples fairly significantly, but do you like, is that a pretty big factor for you? Or
I'd say it is and it isn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I think rules are meant to be broken, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I also think you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
And so look, what if I passed on Protect AI at that round, a $10 million round? So this once again was a very important question for us at Boldstart, which I think will be a very important question for anyone that does quote unquote seed.
Yeah.
Is do I want to play that game, which is the multi-stage game? The multi-stage game is 6 million and above. And how many checks of those can I write? And can I do pro rata in those? We made a conscious decision to play that game. And you know, knock on wood, I would hope that, you know, we have a pretty good ability to pass on the thing. Look, we see tons of those, but we only write a few of those.
Right.
Just to be clear, the jumbos.
Very selectively.
But when I do write the jumbo, I do want to make sure that my fund is big enough to lead or co-lead those rounds and get ownership. So for me, it's about the ownership aspect.
Right.
When I look at the overall portfolio itself, you got to ask yourself the question, is my portfolio better off having these rockstar founders who I perceive as rockstar founders raising $10 million rounds at a higher price mm-hmm. or not? I would believe that if I'm going to write a check in a bigger check, that the outcome is going to be potentially bigger too.
Right. Exactly.
So I have to believe that.
Because I'm curious too, on the financial aspects of VC, you started your fund with $1 million, right? And had some wins and kind of built it over the last 14 years.
Like a founder. That was our inception.
That was round. Your inception
round.
Yeah.
That was, it was a discovery round.
It was your own inception round. I love it. Like, does this guy have what it takes? And For other people that might be doing some angels, they're in the industry, they've got some good deal flow. Like myself, I've done maybe 25 investments and I've followed on Sequoia and Andreessen at the seed and series A.
Yeah.
I've done a few angels, some that worked, some that didn't work out. But, you know, in thinking of launching a fund, what do you think is the right fund size and approach? And I'm sure it could differ depending on who it is, but what's your framework or model around if you're a first time VC, someone like me who might be in the space going to raise their first fund? Like, how much should you attempt to raise? Because you don't want to go too big and bite off more than you can chew, and you want to play the return game. But like, what do you think is a good fund size to start to build traction, but you're still credible?
The answer is different based on people's experiences. But let's just say for a person like you, I'd say, honestly, just the leap of faith going from investing your own money to someone else's capital is a big leap of faith. The second thing I'd say is that scarcity is a very important idea. And so if you try to raise too much and you never get the close done, you know, people will not fund you. So you always want to raise less and have more interest in what you're doing than more. And it also depends on the third one is kind of who your friends are, right? Because perhaps you have a friend that's running a family office willing to give you $10 million. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not, but I think you need to be very thoughtful about what game you're playing, what lane do you want to stay in, and what fund two or three or four would look like. So I'll work backwards and say, if everything went right and I raised $5 million now, do you want to raise $5 million again in 2 or 3 years, just be a solo kind of investor? Or do you want to make the leap of faith and say, maybe I want another partner, or maybe I want a junior partner and scale up my assets? And what ends up happening is the more money you get under management, the game changes, because you perhaps might be able to participate in all the best companies right now with a small 100K check. But when your fund gets too big and you have to write 500K checks or 300K checks, people stop calling you because ownership really, really fucking matters. So perhaps if I were you and you have access to a lot of great deals, unless you want to start leading and eventually the world leads to, just like I said, the cloud providers, eventually you have to lead or co-lead the bigger your fund gets, because you have to have ball control in terms of setting the price, setting the terms, taking the board seat, and actually getting the ownership you want and then helping allocate the rest of it. Because other than that, you know, you have control or you don't. And so if you don't have control, then the question is, what value you bring in? You bring in a shit ton of value to the cap table. Mm-hmm. What is the maximum check size you think you can get in the hottest deals that will generate the most returns for you, or the perceived hottest deals in your mind with the best people that you can allocate safely without people saying he's greedy, he wants too much? That's the question you need to hit. Because when you lead and co-lead, it's a different game, man. It's a different game. You better put your fucking helmet on. You better put your goggles on.
Dude, tell me about that. Cause like, yeah, cause you're going after the hottest deals, right? And you're,
or hopefully perhaps they aren't the hottest
or they're not deals. The hottest deals. Yeah. There's both scenarios, yeah. Right? When they're third time founders.
Yeah. Well, let's assume that guy starting his third company is going to have a lot of
everyone's interest. Hitting guy up. He's a known force in the industry. Right. And those particular deals, how do you compete against Sequoia, Andreessen, Index, Bessemer, Coatue? And maybe it's because you have partnerships with those guys and friendships, so they know your value and they want to co-invest with you. But how do you compete at the 0.001% of venture?
First and foremost, like I'll partner. Like I just partnered with Andreessen and something last year, right? So it just depends, right? If the rounds are big enough, you may just end up partnering with folks. The second thing is, yeah, like we got to put your helmet on, put your cleats on. Let's get out in the field and go do it. And I would hope that me being in the industry for 28 years, ignoring kind of my brand or their brand, is that I can outwork them, and me being there in front of them with the experience that I have. So I think what you get with smaller funds is that you get the senior partners kind of fully engaged, whereas you might be handed off to six different people during a process.
Right.
And I think that the second thing is like, look, I tell the founder, like, hopefully I've added enough value. So it goes back to not tell me what you do, but show me what you do. So during the process of, I just competed with some of those firms on a very large inception around a $15 million cybersecurity round out of Israel that we co-led with another firm. It'll come out soon. But there are a lot of eyes on this thing. And what I did over the course of time was I helped them bring another co-founder on board who was high profile. I introduced them to two of the largest banks as design partners, right? Mm-hmm. So versus saying, hey, I'm going to add value for you, I just went out and did it over time through the natural course of conversation. The very same similar thing that I try to think about when I'm talking to founders, right? Because I would challenge them to say, show me what you got. Well, if I don't show them what I got during the process in this competition, then I shouldn't win. So if I can't deliver the value, if I can't deliver value while we're doing the investment, then what am I going to do after the investment? So ultimately, I think the founders who actually want to get the most value of someone that understands the patience needed to understand that, you know, there is some signaling risk still, I think, from these large multi-stage firms, because do you want to be treated as an option check? A $5 million check from a $7 billion fund, and let's face it, that's like pennies on the couch. That's like picking up pennies, like lifting the sofa while you're vacuuming.
How much skin do they really have in it?
Yeah. So for us, it's fucking meaningful. And so I would hope that I show it, I prove it, and then of course you send your founders in full force who've been there, done that before.
Yes.
So anyway,
I think that's an underrated thing to go in on too, is that skin in the game, that like passion that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Like for me, what I realized, I used to do recruiting for a bunch of Fortune 500 companies, and I got good at it, but I could never be the best because I had no passion for it. I hated bureaucratic companies. I was so bored building teams for like Qualcomm and Intuit. I was bored out of my mind. And then I made a conscious decision. I'm like, all right, well, who would I be inspired to serve?
Yeah.
I was like, I want to work with founders. And I started doing this deep inner work. I'm like, all right, well, why founders? And I'm like, well, I've been an underdog my whole life. Like, I was the loser, kind of outcast kid.
I love it.
Moving around. And I was like, I was never picked first for sports. I just felt like I had this huge chip. And everyone, I felt like, told me I couldn't do things my whole life. Right. And then I, like, you know, when I started seeing some success, I was like, all right, there's something here. I was like, I want to work with people like this.
Yeah.
Like, they're kind of the outcasts, they're kind of the rebels, and they see things that people don't see, but they're willing to bet on themselves and go all in. And they're just these crazy obsessives. And I could relate in the core of my DNA to these people.
Your energy feeds off of them and they feed off of you, right?
Exactly.
And you kind of know that, right? So I would say that's the other thing is that, look, all fabulous firms and they all do their little inception stuff. And look, if it's the third time around going back to Sequoia, I'm not going to beat them. I'll just find a different game to play. But
sure,
if I am going head to head with them and I decide to go head to head with them, then, and I'm putting my effort and time into it, I hope I have a good chance of winning, which I do believe. And that's
because you have this like coursing through your veins. So like, just to understand you and how you became this way, because I think your personality, your DNA is why you're so successful at this. Your parents, right? Their upbringing.
Yeah.
Talk to me about them and your background. And like, I'm curious how you connect those dots from where you're at now.
What you say about being an underdog really resonates with me a lot. I mean, my parents came from Korea as immigrants. So my father was in what technically was North Korea at the time, but it wasn't North Korea. And he and my mom was in South Korea, which at the time was just Korea. And they came with a trunk and my brother, and we had no money, right? And so grew up in Baltimore. My dad started out in like a low-level accountant. My mom was sewing, like, you know, doing sewing clothes, right? And by the way, I'm Asian, right? So I'm Korean, right? My dad, I think there's some Russian blood in it somewhere, but I was also an outcast because I didn't look the same as everyone in Baltimore. And that really forged a lot of my upbringing. And I think also the other thing is that I remember that, you know, the struggle for money, right? My mom would even negotiate Catholic school education tuition. Like, I never thought you could negotiate tuition with the nuns, but my mom went in there and did. She was the most fabulous negotiator. She's fucking intense as hell. She was probably the best businesswoman I'd ever met. And she turned herself from a sewer. She was a fashion artist. By the way, she was a drama major. She ended up getting her stockbroker's license. She ended up being a financial consultant. She was just incredible energy, and she was tough. I mean, the classic story of the Asian parent, like, I'd come back with a 98 in my test, and she's like, why not 100? And then she's like, oh, there's extra credit. Why not 110? I'm like, God damn it, mom. And here's a great example, like, by the way. So like, when I had gotten into Harvard undergrad, fast forward, I got into sports as a young kid when I was like 8. I started playing lacrosse and football. And I remember even playing lacrosse, that was a sport to be cool in Baltimore.
Yeah.
It took me 4 years to catch up with everyone else, but I would go against the wall and throw the ball against myself and everything else. And I just was like, I was determined to catch up because that was the only way you kind of fit in, especially when you don't look the same as everyone else. I ended up going to Loyola High School. We were like number one in the state for 2 years, which means you're number one in the country. And I started getting recruited for college, like all the D1 schools. I remember the coach from Harvard was like, hey, I'd like, you know, check out Harvard. I'm like, oh shit, Ivy League, like, you know, D1, blah, blah, blah. So I ended up going and playing lacrosse there, and it changed my life. Like literally I came from this smaller view of the world. I met people from all over the world. It was the most incredible. I learned about what venture capital was, what private equity was. So that has informed me. It's never going to go away. So I like to say that if you look in the world of AI today, everyone's funding a PhD, right? PhD from Stanford or Cal Berkeley or whatever. You know, the PhDs I'm going to fund are poor, hungry, and determined. And if they happen to have a PhD as well, like a doctorate in AI, great. But if they're poor, hungry, and determined, I can tell you this, they're going to fucking run through walls to get shit done. So I think that energy that you talked about is kind of that, is kind of, no matter how well you do, you always have this feeling knowing what you grew up from and where you came from, that just never lets you stop. And that's kind of where, and that's where I come from. And that's where I meet founders, where there's the energy there and you want to just keep going. They call you, it's, you know, beautiful. So, and that's it. So that's what drives me, you know? Yeah.
I'm curious for you. You know, they say chips on shoulders, put chips in pockets, right? Yep. You have this poor, hungry, determined mindset where it's like, it's almost you're operating out of fear and to some extent, right? Because you don't want to go back to that.
Oh yeah. Like, I remember when my parents fought, the biggest arguments would be around money. Like, how do we-
It's all about money, right?
Yeah. And I hated it. It made me uncomfortable.
At some point that makes you so successful because you're just constantly working towards a better future out of fear and scarcity of returning back to that. And that fear drives you. But at the same time, it can really drain your peace because you're constantly trying to move away from something versus towards something.
Yeah.
Like, have you felt a shift in yourself and your motivation throughout the years where it was like, oh my God, I got to get here. It's about getting somewhere. And then at some point you're able to find that peace and kind of play more of an artist's game and have more fun and create with it. Did you notice any shifts?
Yeah. I got to tell you, there is a seminal moment in Bullstart's history that I kind of think about, and you know, we're not the known quantity at all. And doing what we did was, we were underdogs. We're like, who's building a fucking enterprise seed firm when seed is not even a market and specializing is not a market and you're doing it in New York and enterprise, who cares? And so I remember around fund four, so we started with the $1 million fund. The next fund was 5 and 10 and then became 15. So his next fund was like 16.5 million. Third fund ended up, we put, you know, 20 million in the cover, ended up being 47 million. We had some great companies in there, but once again, the feedback cycles are so long. And then fund four, we put 75 in the cover. And I remember we were getting our first close done for $40 million because you try to always get the first close to be greater than half of the rest. And we're getting ready to close this August. And this large corporate, because we have a very good relationship with these IT groups, were like, they backed out. So all of a sudden, $40 million became 35. And the next day we're going to have the closing and I had to kill the closing. I'm like, I literally fell on the floor. I was like lying on my back. I'm like, holy shit, how are we going to work our way through this? And I totally remember my partner Elliot and I were like, what the hell? And so 20 minutes of lying on the ground, I'm like, all right. So I picked up the phone and called one of our investors, Top Tier Capital, which was our, one of our first institutional LPs outside of this family office called Knollwood, who's been amazing to us. And both of them are all in my LPAC now and still partnering with us. They said, hey, I think I can find a few million dollars for me for another pocket. So they did. So the next morning they found a few million. And then I called and found another 500K from four different people. And so I did, by the end of the next day, got it done. That was the moment where I was gonna either be like, there's no bolt start or there's gonna be a bolt start. And we did have a bolt start. And that fundraise took us 20 months, fund four, to get done. And now like we're in a fortune position, knock on wood, where, you know, we can get rounds done, funds done preemptively when we don't need it and everything else. But that took a long fucking time. And, you know, that is a place, that was a change. Once I got through that and realized that we had brought on some amazing investors like Stepstone and Sapphire and others in that final close, that I was able to breathe a little bit. And then once you're able to breathe, to your point, then you can think differently.
Yeah.
And I've always thought differently. I've always had this, but as you get wiser, you get older, you get to be wiser and more patient. And so I've become much more patient.
Yes. And you can make more clear decisions when you're not frantically scrambling.
Yeah. And so I'm more patient now. And I think it's very important because I have this chart. I'm preparing for our annual meeting. And I like to say, it's not how long it takes for you to get to $1 million. That's not the marker. And it's how fast you go from 1 to 5 to 10. And I'll give you a great example. Sneaker took 3.5 years to get there. And then to get to 10, it didn't take them much longer.
Well, look at Figma. I mean, they did 5 years with no revenue and then 400 million in 5 years after.
Clay in our portfolio. Clay's do you use Clay? 6 years wandering around the desert to get their first million. And now then we just closed the most recent round. So they went from under a million in 1 year and then, you know, mid-single digits, millions next year. Now we're going to do a lot more and we close around at 500 post. So,
wow.
But the thing is, but it's ramping like crazy. So the point is that the patience though,
the patience
to not lose your mind.
And that's why you talk about the importance of conviction because it's so hard.
Yeah.
It'll take everything in your soul to stay the course when there's no signals yet.
Yeah. And if the founders, and you might ask like kind of, how do you know to stick with things? Well, it's the founders. The founders are so passionate. I trust the founders. They're going to see the lights differently, but sometimes I do have to bring them some reality and say, hey, I think there's six people I walked you into and they're just like customers and they're just saying, isn't your value prop's not working. Like, we got to change it. But if the founders are still passionate and still sticking with it and they're still putting their time, blood, sweat, and tears into it and they see something and they give you signs of what they're seeing, then yeah, you got to keep going. And so that, I think, to your point, has allowed me to, that patience is very important.
I got one last question for you.
Yeah.
Hypothetical. You get to write one email to the whole world. 8+ billion people get to read this one email from you. And you get to share one piece of advice or a couple statements on how to live a happier, more fulfilling life with all the wisdom you've acquired over the years now. What would you want to share with the world?
Wow. That's pretty intense, man. I would say pursue your passion and go for it. And then the sub-corollary would be, I would hope that you surround yourselves with people that allow you to do the former. Because pursuing your passion and going for it may mean that you're working obscurity for years. Bullstar was an obscure, we weren't even on the map for until a few years ago, to be honest with you, but it didn't matter. The founders that knew us liked us, and there are nobodies too, by the way, right? So, you know, when we funded Rahul from Superhuman, no one knew who he was at Reportive.
Yeah.
Now everyone knows who Rahul is.
Yeah.
But those are the people, those are the underdogs, right? So, but then the second part would be, you need to have people that believe in you. So my wife, Kathy, I've been with her since a year after college. And I remember, and this is very important, when I decided to start Boldstart, because founders kept coming to me and telling me that they don't need a lot of capital. And I'm like, Kath, we're gonna have to drain our savings. I'm not gonna get a salary for, I don't know how long. And by the way, the funds that are raised is not gonna be that big anyway. And she's like, Ed, I would rather you do something you love and wake up loving every day because I believe in you, than taking a bigger salary at a large firm and being one of 12 partners flying miserably to the West Coast, trying to convince them why the New York City founder who's doing the same thing as the San Francisco founder is more worthy of being bet on. And she did not waver from that. I'm talking about mortgage, two kids in private school. She fucking did not waver from that. And if you don't have people like that behind you, and my kids knew the ups and downs too, like they would be in the car driving to a hockey tournament 8 hours away, listen to pitch calls. But if your family and your people or whoever it is that you're surrounding, your friends, don't have that conviction, and there are times where I almost wanted to just stop too, but she just kept saying going, right? So you have to surround yourselves with people in order to do the first part.
Do you think Bold Start would have been successful without Kathy?
No. And Elliot says that too. Because like, it's fucking lonely and hard being a founder. So I also have empathy for founders because it's not like, you know, my B round was fucking brutal. You know, I have a lot of empathy for founders, what they go through. And in fact, a lot of the things that we were told not to do as a VC firm, we did anyway. And then eventually it's like, oh, it's working for you guys. But we were not the pattern for everything that people did, investing across the globe, investing in tons in Israel, not being in the same location, doing enterprise out of New York, everything you can imagine, staying on boards until exit. Which seed firms gets on the board from the very beginning and stays on to the exit? I mean, are you guys nuts? Like, we did everything the opposite way, but that was the way that we knew how to build our business because we saw with the founders, we reacted to the founders. The answer is no, we would not exist without Kathy.
Wow, this is an incredible interview, Ed. I got so much from this. Thank you so much for doing this, man. I cannot wait for people to hear this.
Dude, I'm so appreciative to be on a podcast like this because I'm almost embarrassed to see this name on it because I'm just like, I'm always like, you got to be better. You know what I mean? So, but thank you.
Winners always feel like they're losing.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Thank you for having me, dude. This was awesome. And I look forward to doing more stuff with you in Miami.
Same here, brother.